So today's topic is on good governance, and Barbara, our facilitator, will explore setting up effective processes to make and implement decisions for community-based not-for-profit organisations. And just a few words on Barbara. Barbara holds a Master of Education in Strategic Leadership and Management, and she's got a passion for governance in not-for-profit organisations. She has over 30 years of professional and personal experience across management and leadership, capacity building, strategic and business planning, community development and education, public health issues and community responses, monitoring and evaluation, youth affairs, gender issues, financial management and native title. And Barbara has also worked with me in our local soccer club to review our constitution. So impressive CV, and Barbara, I'll hand over to you. Thank you.
Thanks, Henrik. I sound like a bit of a geek, a governance geek, don't I? Welcome everybody, and thank you, Henrik, for inviting me to present this session to you. So together today, Henrik's given an invitation, an introduction, sorry, and we now know from the list who's actually here. I just want to say that one of the things about governance and good governance is that there's a whole range of interchangeable language, and it's really dependent on the size of your organisation and how you operate. So I just want to say that during this presentation, where I talk about a board, if you have a committee of management, then it's interchangeable, and including also with the senior staff, if you see CEO, because we'll talk about a CEO, it's your senior staff person who reports to the board, so that could also be a manager or a coordinator, depending on, again, the size and nature of your service. Sometimes they are general managers. So it's just general language. It does still relate to you, even if you are known as a committee of management, for instance. So in consultation with Henrik and Catherine, there's so many things to do with governance that we could talk about, but they selected these five. What is good governance? Your constitution, governance versus operations, an agenda that works, and not for loss. We talk about not for profit a lot, but we've got just a little bit of conversation around not for loss. In an hour, I've set aside probably about 10 minutes for each of those topics, which doesn't seem like a lot, but what I'll do is I'll present, there's two or three slides on each topic, I'll present the slides and then we'll actually have time for some questions directly following. If we get to the end, and we've still got outstanding questions and a little bit of time, we'll be able to pick those up there too. This session is primarily directed at people on boards. It's not directed at the staff or at the CEO, general manager. There is a reason for that, which is that the board has its own responsibilities and its own accountabilities outside of its work with the CEO. So I'm not sure what the mix-up of who we have online today is. I'm hoping that there's some board members, because what I will say a bit later is it's not actually, one of the key things about good governance is it's not the senior officer's role to train the board. The board's actually responsible for that. So generally, there are a whole range of definitions about governance. This is one I use, which is governance is the legal authority given to the board to manage the affairs of the organisation. So that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the authority, the legal authority and accountability that's given to a board to manage the affairs of your organisation. So where good governance comes, is good governance is the process by which the board make and implement those decisions. So it's the process that's used in having that legal authority. And then there's organisational governance, which is where the rubber hits the road in relation to the organisation that they govern, which is the stewardship of those decisions. So it's not just making them, it's ensuring that they're actually implemented and what processes are in place to ensure that implementation happens. There are legal obligations, which you'll find in any of your insurance documents that you'll all have, which is that board members must understand the needs of the organisation and their own legal responsibility and liability. So for anyone that's actually standing for or on a board or a committee of management, individuals are really, it's like any rule of law, individuals actually completely responsible for ensuring that they know where this sits for them. It's kind of like driving a car and you have your license. You know, you get your license because you prove that you understand what the rules are. It's very similar. It's that you need to understand what the rules of running your organisation is to be able to then effectively govern it. Excuse me. And that does include legislation. For instance, I've used their privacy requirements. But most boards anywhere in Australia can be responsible for 50 and upwards pieces of legislation, whether it be privacy, whether it be equal opportunity, whether it be employment law, occupational health and safety. There's a whole range of state and territory and federal legislation that any board of any organisation of any size actually has responsibility for. Having said that, good governance is actually more than compliance. Now, these five things listed here actually come from the United Nations has a What is Good Governance paper, and it identifies eight principles of good governance. And the Institute on Governance, which is an independent Canadian non-profit think tank that does a lot of work around governance, in 1990 to kind of promote better governance for public interest and for non-profit organisations and over in Canada for First Nation organisations, they broke the eight that the UN has come down to of principles to these five. So these are the five principles. So it is a shared vision. It's ethical leadership. It's representation, democratic decision making, and transparency and accountability. This can sometimes be the most difficult thing because people come with their own personal and experience to a board. They might be representing a particular interest. They might be small membership driven. The directors may actually not, in boards there's the representation kind of approach, but there's also the skills-based approach. But when on the board is to act in the interest of the organisation as a whole. So it's not just part of the organisation, it's actually around the whole organisation and how that sits and how moving it forward. And no matter what the other interest of directors, when at this board meeting, you act on its interests. And that's important because of this. In the non-profit and education sector, a board member could be any one of these things. Could be volunteers in the service, could be a staff person, could be representing another board. So people that come from another organisation who are representative. They might be employed by another organisation, they may be a community member, a service user, or just friends. The issue with that is around, it's not saying if you're any of those things you can't be on a board, it's just saying that you need to be aware that there's conflicts in that there's lots of hats. But when you're at this board, you are there for this board. And how you manage those conflicts is really the most key thing. So it's not about avoiding them, it's about managing them. And most organisations will have something in their constitution about how a conflict is managed. For instance, if someone declares they have a conflict, they will leave the room while the discussion is occurring and for the vote. Some organisations may have that they can be party to the conversation, but not party to the vote. That's becoming rarer because it is understood that in some settings influence can still be given by being in the room when there is a clear conflict. And the other thing, there's generally a joint process. So the person can declare a conflict, or the chair or president who's chairing the meeting can raise the question of if someone has a conflict. And then the board as a whole can decide, even if the person doesn't think that they do have. In terms of managing the organisation as a whole, there are some basic principles around that which are you know, individuals can't act on behalf of a project unless they're given the right delegations to do that, or act on behalf of one community group at a board level. They might be there because of a different organisation, but as I said, when in this room, when in this meeting, their focus needs to be on progressing this organisation. So that's a little bit about the part about the board and how the board meets and some of those processes and principles. Before we get on to the constitution, I'm happy to see if there are any questions or even examples, you know, that we could have a look at in the chat there. Okay.
So question, Mrs. Henrik. Now, you mentioned the legal responsibility and liabilities and mentioned the privacy legislation, and you said there was up to 50 or more different pieces of legislation that people need to be aware of. Where would one go to find information about what we need to know?
I would suggest that the first place is the Consumer Affairs Office within your state or territory. So the place where you constitute, whoever is the body that receives and accepts an organisation's constitution, they would have a responsibility to assist you to know those things. And it is tricky, but it's asking the basic question, do we employ staff? Yes. So what are all of the things we need to consider? There's occupational health and safety, there's equal opportunity, there's bullying, harassment, there's all of those kinds of things. Not everybody needs to know everything, but you do need to know the basics. So governance training would normally, for a board to really wrap their head around all of their responsibilities moving forward and be really comfortable, you know, you're looking at least a full-day seminar or something. This is as an introduction to that, but I would be going to the government office who accepts your constitution. So in Victoria, where I'm based, that is the Office of Consumer Affairs.
I'd like to ask a question, if I may, George. Two things. How relevant, or is there much difference between associations and companies limited by guarantee in your talk? That's the first thing. The second thing is, you've mentioned the conflict of interest where a board member has a friend on the board. A CEO has a friend on the board. How relevant is that? And I'd be appreciate your comment about it.
With the first one, you will have different compliance to different government departments depending on how you are incorporated. So if you are a company limited by guarantee, you're obviously going to have different compliance matters to do with an association or any of the other ways that you can incorporate nationally. There are a variety of ways. Some are incorporated to their state or territory office. Some organisations are incorporated federally. In relation to this introduction to governance, it's relevant across the board because good governance, whether it's BHP or whether it's the local soccer club, has the same principles. Because it is based on international principles around that. Okay. The bit about the constitution, which comes next, might be different depending on how you're constituted. In relation to conflict of interest, there are many conflicts continually. The fact that conflict exists is not the issue for a board. How the board manages it is the issue. There could be partners. You know, there could be partners on a board. There could be, whether that's business partners or life partners. That part doesn't matter. What matters is that a conflict is identified whenever matters arise. Okay, thank you so much. Okay, so moving right along, I'm already running late, isn't it? So about your constitution. It's my experience in all of these many years of being a governance geek that most people write a constitution, put it on a shelf and drag it out once a year to see how they're meant to call an AGM. Going back to the car licence idea again, this is actually your legal contract with the government, no matter how you're incorporated, of how you're going to run your organisation. I'd suggest like a driver's licence. You keep it on you at all the important parts. So in Victoria, if you drive a car, you have to have your licence on you. I'd suggest that there needs to be at least a copy of a constitution at every single board meeting, just in case. I also recommend that any new members actually are given a full copy and understand what they're signing on to, preferably prior to them nominating, but if not, then certainly after. So it really is a contract. It's, you say that you are going to run your organisation to the standards of whatever the piece of legislation that governs your organisation is. As I said, as legislation does vary from state to state and territories, it's worth, you know, always staying up to date with what your particular constitution requirements are. The purpose for a constitution really is to outline your reason for being. It's about saying how you're going to operate and how you're going to comply with whatever legislation is, recognising that the legislation is, you know, is considered law of the land. So it's about saying to the government, we're going to run this and you're going to oversight us running this in the best interest of whatever your community is. It's critical if any of you as organisations also have any form of tax breaks, whether it's as a DGR or a public benevolent institution or through an educational institution, it's really critical then that not only your constitution is up to date, but that you can show evidence that you are meeting it. Because with a whole range of those tax benefits, I would suggest, they are often relatively easy to get. They are more difficult to keep, because you must annually show evidence that you are meeting the requirements of your constitution and therefore the requirements of the ATO to meet those requirements. So as I said, your constitution is a legally binding contract that you make with the government. It should be consistent and in fact inform the way that you run your organisation. And it shouldn't just sit on the shelf and be brought out annually to, what are we meant to do now? I understand that that's what happens. I get that. But I think it's really important, and I think that most states and territories are getting a little bit more sophisticated around how they offer constitutions now. There's often model constitutions if they're federated organisations. There are how-to rights constitutions. There are draft ones that you can just insert your bits. That's really helpful. Just make sure that everyone understands what's in it. It's not just something that you tick off so that you can then move forward with being an organisation. So our third topic, which is very often a tricky one, because it is the relationship between the board and the CEO, or the board and the general manager, is a really important one in how it is actually developed and sustained. Each of those two parties have a role of their own to implement. Some of that they do together, some of that they do by themselves. So we're just going to talk a little bit about the difference between governance and operations. Some people would say governance and management, and where that sits. So as mentioned, the board's responsible for compliance. It's responsible for strategic planning, so setting the actual direction of the organisation. Now, whilst the board might not understand that process, or undertake that process, I should say, they are certainly the only authority that can approve a strategic plan. So not an operational plan, a strategic plan of the direction of the organisation must be set down by the board. The annual budget is the same. The board is ultimately responsible for the financial management of any organisation, and therefore it is the board that needs to approve and completely understand the budget so that then they can monitor that through reporting, however that's set up. The board's responsible for the appointment and the review of the manager, that would be CEO, and that's a really important thing. Depending on the size of the organisation, the CEO might be, or the manager might be, the only person that the board's responsible for employing. And then that CEO or manager may be responsible for oversighting the employment of the rest of the people in the organisation. Again, comes down to size. I know organisations where there's only a few staff very often may have a board member on the panel. but it is legally only responsible and accountable to employ that one person. And then managers, where governance becomes operations, is where the delegations of authority come in. So the board will delegate authority in running the organisation to that senior manager, and that could be employing staff, the day-to-day and business management. Just a note on that, the board can delegate anything except the appointment of the CEO, the acceptance of the strategic plan and the annual budget. Those things in most states or territories are absolutely the responsibility of the board. Whether it's written in your constitution or not, in that language, it will say something about setting the direction of the organisation. To do that, you need to employ the right staff in the senior role, and you need to develop that or oversight that budget. You can delegate to individual members. You might delegate to subcommittees, to your CEO, to any staff. Some people delegate to external companies. So a standard delegation might be a financial one, for instance, where you would delegate that for operational purposes. You delegate the expenditure against budget of certain amounts that are in budget. So if your budget has $20,000 program operating budget, you know how that's broken down because you've already accepted and approved the annual budget, then your CEO can go ahead and get that done. And that would be an obvious delegation. What they can't do is go and develop or spend that allocated money on different or new programs without it being checked somewhere. So again, depending on the size of the organisation, large organisations might have an executive finance committee, which would be made up of your treasurer, your chair and your CEO. So there's a checking point always. This is why it's incredibly important to actually sign off on the budget at the very front end. External companies. There are some companies that will subcontract in other companies to come and run programs. What I would suggest is that what anyone who is delegated can't do, as I said, is change the forward strategy of an organisation. And often if you have subcommittees, you wouldn't give them decision-making powers. A subcommittee would work on a matter and they would bring that matter back to the board for a decision. So the board still makes the decision that the subcommittee may be involved in, researching, discussing, meeting certain topics, whether it be program development, whether it be relationships development, could even be the strategic plan development, but it comes back to the board. So as I said before, I do come back to this a couple of times, to act in the interests of the organisation as a whole. So through all of that, it's the board's responsibility, and this is where those conflicts are really important. Someone can't act in the interest of the organisation that they're actually representing on the board, or act in the interest of their best mate who happens to be on the board. They need to actually act in the interest of the board that you're on. And the second little part of that only decisions of the board are binding unless those delegations are in place. This is really important, and we'll come back to it in a second. But it's really important when you talk about the relationship between the board and the CEO. So as I said, the board's got one employee technically, and that is the CEO. They approve the position description, they approve the payment of that person collectively. They organise the recruitment, they delegate day-to-day. They may delegate the day-to-day oversight of the manager to one of the directors, which would usually be the chairperson. So the manager or the CEO isn't having to report or seek guidance from the entire board every time they need to move forward. They have one person who's actually across what they are doing and managing them and managing their performance. It is the board's role to support the CEO to do their job, including establishing, that should say a contract, I'm sorry, and establish those delegations, but also conduct regular performance reviews. Small print. Only decisions of the board are binding. This is really important in managing your CEO. The CEO is under no obligation at all to follow any individual direction from any director or board member. And in fact, should report any cases of where someone's tried to individually influence them directly back to the board. So you're, as a board member, you can't walk into an organisation and tell the CEO what to do, particularly if you don't have the responsibility of the delegation of oversight of their management. You're actually bound by the collective decisions. And as Hendrik said, I've been around for a while and I've yet to work in an organisation where this doesn't happen, including local government and government departments or education facilities, where a director doesn't walk in and say, I just really need this done. Can you get that done? And it's an impact on the CEO's workload. It's an impact because it's not a board decision to get it done, it's just someone thinks it's a good idea. And on the negative side, it might even be a direction of something that in fact was not supported by the board, but because the individual really wants it done, they think that they can get it done by going directly. That's not good governance. Good governance isn't by individual. So an agenda that works, it might sound a bit silly, but no one wants to actually dread meetings by not knowing how long they're going to go for, whether or not there's going to be a lot of conflict, you know, what's going on. So the very first thing about an agenda that works is that there needs to be an agenda, and preferably an agenda that's distributed prior to the meeting so people can do some thinking about what's going on. In my day job, where I'm involved in a variety of other committees and boards and things, I like to receive an agenda, if not all the papers, at least 3 or 4 days prior. But certainly the agenda is really important. If you struggle to get members on the board, these are some of the things that can really assist to have really get really good outcomes from your meetings, but also have really good participation by people. Because most boards are voluntary, which means that someone is deciding to give up their time, whether it be weekly or monthly or however often, to this organisation. In doing that, it's like you don't just give away money without knowing where it's going. People shouldn't be asked to give away their time, whether it's 3 or 4 hours a month or whatever, without actually knowing where it's going. So the idea of an agenda is to make it relevant and appropriate and also have one. The other thing is around making meetings consistent. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the kinds of things to have on an agenda and the regularity that you do that, but also about what a standard agenda might look like. And I'm sure everyone will have examples of agendas that aren't standard. But on this page here, there are some important things that need to be on agendas. However, some of them are not every meeting. So conflict and CEO or senior manager report, absolutely all meetings. Finance, absolutely all meetings. But things like a staff satisfaction survey or a customer or client satisfaction or even external reports around accreditation, you know, they don't have to be as often. They annually it might be good. Some smaller organisations might not do a staff survey because there's only 3 people and you get a sense as you're going along that you don't need to do an actual survey. But things like finding out what's happening in your programs, program reports, whether you do that as an annual report to a board or whether you pull them up as they happen. So as a program finishes, the board receives a report. So there's common sense around this kind of reporting, which is around just scheduling. So your annual acquittal happens annually. Obviously, probably put it in, depending on when your meeting is, July or August, if you're on a financial year. Every year you know it's coming. Funding agreements, probably the same. I mean, they might be a bit earlier. You'd hope that you know about funding for a coming financial year prior to July. But those funding agreements, and this isn't the signing off, because depending on your delegation, your CEO might sign off on money that's coming into the organisation under a proper delegation. But annually, the board needs to know exactly all the grants that have come in just one report. It could be a page. Got this, got it from here, this is how much, this is what it was for. It's going to show up in the annual budget anyway, and sometimes an annual budget will identify program funds that you haven't got yet, so it's about coming back and saying, yep, we've got this, so we're good. So there's the idea of what might occur, you know, in what kind of regularity. I was on the board or a committee of a neighbourhood house in Victoria, and regularly the meetings went for 4 or 5 hours, and at least 3/4 of that was the CEO report, because the CEO report was loaded with decisions that the CEO wanted. That's not where decision making reports lie. Anything that requires a decision should be its own agenda item. It's worth thinking about, if the board is responsible for the annual budget, your strategic plan and your staffing, where you actually spend your time on the board, because they're the areas to spend it. So an agenda that works would include your statutory responsibilities, so for instance finances. Larger organisations might only have a quarterly report because there is an executive finance committee in place. Small organisations would need to have them monthly, because you need to really check year against your against budget. Organise your agenda in order of responsibility, not in order of interests. This is often tricky in the kind of work that you do, because the reason people nominate and volunteer for boards in the community sector, education sector, sporting sector, is because they have a passion for the community, for the sport, or for education. So they'll be really interesting agenda items, but they might not actually be things that the board needs to make a decision on. So it's about using time wisely. And I'd say standardise your agenda. So I'd always suggest that matters for decision come first, and they're decisions that you make. Matters for discussion. This might be where your interesting things go. It's also, I would suggest, for instance, if sometimes your CEO is developing a response to a government inquiry, for instance, that you might discuss that, and then a month later it might be a matter for decision about actually sending it. But you create some time and allow time for discussion around things that might need more than a taken as read report, for instance. I know that most people in this sector don't like the idea of having a taken as read report, so a report's distributed, and when it comes up in the matter for decision, it's taken as read. That people have already read it. If they have questions, they're ready. If there are no questions, then the decision is made. You don't need to spend 20 minutes on something that everyone agrees with. Do that over coffee afterwards. And then matters for noting. So a matter for noting in a large organisation would be your CEO report. For instance, some of you might have it for discussion and some of you may have it for decision. Depends on your delegation of how your CEO reports against their work plan, or more importantly, against your strategic plan. You can run a small to medium-sized community organisation as a board with a once-a-month meeting that probably goes no more than 3 to 4 hours. depending on the technicality, so legal organisations, which I do a lot of work with, where a lot of the reports are legal, it's more. That might be 4 hours a fortnight. But again, it comes down to the size. What is really difficult for anyone who wants to volunteer to a board, as I said, is if you're having a meeting that starts at 6 and you don't know if you're going to be out by 10 or by 11. So it's really important that you work out an agenda that's workable, but that you get the decisions made and that you understand how much time you're needing to give up or you're asking of the person to attend. Are there any questions?
There's a question from George. It says, where and if so do the board hear about correspondence to the board?
Okay.
If I could just make a comment, Barbara. Something that happens from time to time, the boards that I've been involved with, where people who are concerned about things send letters to the board and the board never hears about it. Is there an appropriate time when those documents should be put and made available to the board to let them know what's happening?
Yes. Absolutely. So what I would say is any community organisation or educational, anyone that deals with the public, needs to have some kind of complaints policy. Where, for instance, you may, because the reality is people complain. So how you deal with that will, again, come down to the size of your organisation. So large organisations might leave the complaints to the CEO and one board member to deal with. You know, it's common for large organisations to operate off portfolios. So each director might have a particular portfolio. Someone might be responsible for the CEO's work plan. Someone might be responsible for correspondence, including complaints or grievances. Someone might have finance and insurance. There are ways to do that. Any correspondence that is directed to the board does need to come on a register and does need to actually be brought to the board unless there's a delegation saying that your CEO can respond. I would suggest that if someone has taken the time to complain or write a letter about something to the board as opposed to the CEO, then the board can only respond to it. Unless you have correspondence, a delegation that says your CEO can make the first response back to that person, then all matters should actually come to the board. And that would be a correspondence register. I mean, you don't want to have to be, people will, you know, write to you about stuff. And I can't think of any examples in that you may have. But there might be a lot of, you know, sales pitches, new programs that an independent body wants to run. And they'll often write to the board instead of the CEO. I would say the most simplest delegation is if it's a matter of a program that you're running or a new program or one that you're running, then your CEO could be delegated to actually respond to that. However, if it's about the organisation, if it's about someone thinking that you're not running to where your strategic plan says or your budget, then that must be presented to the board. In most instances, that would be sent directly to your chairperson as soon as it comes in. You wouldn't wait a month to see that. Well, you shouldn't wait a month to see that. Most people wouldn't have heard the expression not for loss because I made it up just because I've worked in many, many organisations that are not for profit, but very often they ran programs for loss. And that would then, and there'd be a lot of cross-financing. So one program would do really well and that money that it made, because we don't like to talk about profit in community, but the reality is we need to make some. So additional money that comes out of one program would cross-subsidise one that's not going well, but we think it's a really good idea to keep going. I would challenge any board to actually change that thinking to not for loss. And that's at an organisational level, but also at a program level. So things like, very often, educational or community educational organisations are asked
to Auspice projects that are pretty much independent. However, they will take time of your CEO, or they will take time of your program manager, they will take time somewhere, which is a cost to your organisation. And you need to be really clear as a board how much time you are giving, what that cost is in real dollars. Because for the 5 hours spent with an Auspice body a month is 5 hours not spent on something that might be closer to your strategic plan. So that's why I talk about not for loss. So it's about understanding why your organisation exists. And that will be articulated in your constitution, but mostly in your strategic plan. It's about understanding that your board has a commitment and a responsibility to long-term sustainability. It's kind of like, the benefit of community organisations is you don't think only in terms of your term on the board. So you don't think, I'm only going to be here for 2 years, so I'm only going to make decisions that are important for these 2 years. You're not a government that has to be re-voted in on that, who regularly does that, who doesn't think long term. You're an organisation that everybody that comes in, whether you're there for a year or 10 years, has a responsibility to the sustainability and the ongoing operation of that organisation. And like I said, sometimes we make decisions about being not-for-profit, but rarely do we consider not-for-loss. So this is just a really practical few steps around the things to ask yourself in making your organisation have a look at its practice from a not-for-loss angle. So you might, for instance, any new program that comes up, you might have a little mini feasibility where you ask yourself some questions, or your CEO asks the questions and then reports it to you. Your first one's obviously going to be, is it in the strategic plan and does it come with money? Or is it something where there's guaranteed money? Because that's also, there's a good idea, but a good idea that your CEO then spends 20 hours on where you really aren't sure if it's going to come off, you need to be really critical about that as an investment of their time. If it's something that is, we know the money's there, we're going to get it, we just need to put together this, and it's within the strategic plan, then obviously that's a no-brainer. So it's around setting objective criteria for any new project project development. Like I said, is it consistent with your strategic plan? Will it cover its own cost? Can you gain some administration? I would always say that anyone considering auspicing another program, for instance, you've got to have an administration fee. If they're going to get funding and they require you and your tax break for them to get the funding, then you need to get some of those funds, whether it's a 10% or a 25%. Building in an administration percentage into every single grant that you write. So again, whether it's 10% or 25%. Because often grants are for projects only, but you have to manage your service. You've got to pay for the phones, the rent, you know, those kinds of things. So it's about having a criteria around it. Like I said, include an auspice fee on any group and the admin fee on all grant applications. It's really critical, but also, just going back to the first point, part of the criteria is how much investment of your CEO's time do you want to make. So if your CEO is paid, I don't know, let's say $30 an hour, 10 hours of their time developing a new project and trying to find money is a $300 investment. For small organisations, that's a lot. For larger organisations, it might not be. For larger organisations, some of the submissions or tender you write are going to take more than 10 hours. So it's always about costing the actual resources to go that go in to trying to get additional resources back, and thinking of it. It's not a business perspective. It's just a not for loss perspective, which then speaks to the sustainability of your organisation.
I've got a question, if I can, Barbara. What happens where a board can't be able to make a decision. Is there an outside body that you can turn to get an advice or get a third opinion?
Can you give me an example of why they can't make a decision? Is it?
Well, one of the complications I've seen on boards, and we've actually got it in councils too, where the vote is 50-50 and there's no situation, and often the chairman doesn't want to make that casting decision, believing that the board should be making that decision themselves rather than left to the decision made by the chairman. So is there
my answer is going to be in two parts. The first one is that I would suggest you have a look at your constitutions, because most constitutions now, and it's common practice now, that what you would have in a constitution for voting purposes is what's called a simple majority. Now, a simple majority is actually half plus one. So if you have 10, that's six people have to actually agree on whatever. So have a look at your constitutions, and you would have one or the other. You would have the chairperson having the casting vote. The chairperson, if they've accepted the role and that's outlined in the constitution, doesn't really have the opportunity to shy away from that. If you accept a role where it's very clear that your role might be the casting vote, then you need to give a casting vote sometimes. So I think that's around people completely understanding what their role is if they take on that chair role. So if the constitution says that chair or president has the casting vote, then only someone who's prepared to make that casting vote can have that role. It's part of the job. In relation to decisions that are stuck, if it's stuck, clearly half and half, no one's budging. The first step that any government agency is going to tell you is get a mediator to actually mediate a decision, because they won't want to get involved. But they'll say, you know, work this out in this way. Many boards actually don't even have a simple majority. Many will have the word that completely escapes me that means everyone has to agree. Isn't that funny? Okay. So I'd be looking at the constitution saying if it's 50-50 for a start, that's got to change. And in the meantime, if a chairperson has taken on that role, understanding that they have a deciding vote, then they need to use it. If you have a chairperson that refuses to use a deciding vote, even if it's in the constitution, then yes, that's a compliance matter. And you would need to take it to the government body who you are constituted with.
I would suggest that you'd have to take it to ASIC, and when you go to ASIC, they usually tell you they haven't got the time or the resources to talk to you.
That's exactly right, which means that what they would say is get a moderator. I think that depending on the size of the organisations, for large organisations, some decision-making processes, I've worked with organisations where we have a simple chart that says, can you make a decision? No. Is it because you don't have a majority of voters to make a decision, whatever the decision is? And if the answer to that is yes, because three people say yes, three people say no, and three people abstain, the next question would be, if you're looking to agree to a motion, why are the people abstaining? What's their reason for abstaining? And can that be addressed? And then what's the reason for people voting against the motion? Can that be addressed? And you chunk it down. So your end motion might not be exactly what the one that was originally put is, but at least you have a decision of some kind.
Yes, it's an interesting thing. You raised the point that I thought was very valid in your earlier discussion, that where you've got a board where a significant number of members on that board are friends of the CEO, you have a problem on your hands, but but you said today that those people officially would have to declare a conflict of interest, and I think that that's something I hadn't considered before.
They absolutely would. So if a friend or family or something, and this is part of the reason why I start by saying this presentation and governance training is for the board. It's never for the CEO or for the manager. They can be there because they need to understand good governance. But a board shouldn't just be filled with mates who then everyone's, unless it's a collective, like it's a legal collective where the CEO has an equal casting vote in there, the board has a responsibility of its own. I work with a lot of Indigenous organisations doing governance, and Indigenous organisations are very often, particularly Native Title ones, across the Eastern Seaboard and across the top. Their boards are representative of their family groups, and their family groups are based on their ancestral contacts. So the ancestors are named, and then each of those ancestors' descendants have a place, have one, you know, person at the board. So everybody knows each other. And everybody, well, certainly in the Eastern Seaboard, may even be related. But up north, they didn't have the mission system that we had in the southeast, so those minglings may not have happened. So it is often that people are even related that sit on the board, and whether that means they do like each other or they don't like each other. These things are everywhere and in every board. It's not about what relationship you have with somebody. It's about how you declare that and how that relationship informs your decision, because you're not there to just progress the desires of your staff person. You're there to progress the aspirations of the whole community through your strategic plan.
Great. Thanks, Barbara. Final question from Jenny. She's asking, from a governance point of view and being not for loss, how much money is it reasonable to have in the bank? 6 months, a year worth of operating costs? What's the next adequate buffer?
I would suggest that you start with solvency. So by law, you have to start with solvency, so you have to make sure that you can pay out every debt you've got, including if you've got an annual lease on a property, you know, those kinds of things. Again, dependent on size, smaller organisations on top of solvency may only be able to have a buffer of 10%. In larger organisations that I have worked with, where the services are predominantly externally funded, then it is certainly closer to 25 or 30% where possible. The other thing is, don't keep it in the bank, actually manage it. If you're big enough to have a 30% buffer, have it in a term deposit or put it in an ethical investment somewhere or do something with it so it's actually making you money. So the bigger you get, I mean, there's whole programs around financial stuff, but obviously you need a cash flow, so you need to know how much money you're expending every month. So some things, if you have a large, you know, if you have a workforce of maybe 15 people, you're going to have a fairly big superannuation bill, but you might only pay it quarterly. So whilst that's building up, put it somewhere where it's earning interest for you and making money for you, and then you pull it back to actually make the payment when you can. So like I said, it's size dependent. Start with solvency and then, you know, start at 10%.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Barbara.